be taken under advisement. And we will move on to the third case of our morning, Don Leitner against York.
May it please the court, my name is John Williamson. I'm the attorney for the appellant, Harold E. Son Leitner. This is a 1983 case. He was a nurse supervisor at a state institution. He was demoted on the basis of 7 charges brought against him. 4 of those charges, which I consider more serious, that he was dishonest, neglecting his duties as supervisor, failing to participate in treatment activities, and spending his time watching television. No notice of those charges were brought to him. They did bring charges of three other charges against him. It's our position that under that his constitutional right to
a Loudermill is a discharge case, right? This is a demotion case, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. But he has a property interest under Wisconsin law in his demotion cases, and the Loudermill has been extended to demotion cases. So that it's our position that a decision maker cannot, consistent with Loudermill, pick and choose which charges to give him notice and the opportunity to respond, and which ones to deny him that right.
So could I try to rephrase your argument just to make sure I understand it properly? You're saying, number one, that he didn't have notice or hearing on several of the charges, which may indeed have been dispositive, that he was demoted, and that because the state authorities never acted on the statement in his appeal to give him a new supervisory position when one became available, that he remains demoted, and therefore that's why you're looking for both damages and injunctive relief? Is that
yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Well, the basic complaint is that he has not been reinstated as a supervisor, right? Is that correct?
That's correct, but I think that's an issue for the district court as to determine what would be the proper relief at the time that the decision comes down.
Isn't there a procedure in Wisconsin law where he could have, if he thought he was commission conclusion was not being put into effect, namely that he was not being given his whole job back, he could have gone in and sought enforcement of the decision, couldn't he? And
that's
Wisconsin
correct, Your Honor.
Procedure. That's so when you're saying that there's a defect in constitutional defect in Wisconsin procedure, you have to take that into account. I mean, Wisconsin provides a remedy for your problem, seems to me.
Well, I beg to differ under Schultz v. Bongrat by this court. It ruled that you don't have to exhaust your state procedures where there's a denial of your pre-deprivation procedure. And in this case, by the way, I made the mistake. I thought that I filed on time, they give you 60 days, we didn't even know, I mean, you don't know whether they're going to comply with it until some time passes. But under the statute itself, you not only have to file in court, which is the normal procedure in Wisconsin, but you have to serve the person, and they were served too late. There was a mistake. I did join a state and a federal claim in this situation. But on a pre-deprivation
your claim is you were deprived of due process, and you were afforded a due process by this statute, which you apparently weren't able to comply with. So why is there a constitutional problem?
My client was deprived of due process because he was entitled to a pre-deprivation hearing. In Loudermill, one of the people had a full hearing and was found that the charges that he were brought against him were upheld. In this case, all four charges were found on the merits to be without any basis. Now, in that case, they said there was the need to have the discretion exercised by the decision makers. That was number one. Number two, their discretion would be influenced by accurate information that the person who the charges, against whom the charges are made, would have the opportunity to call to their attention to avoid inaccurate, which clearly occurred here, decision making.
I thought they did partially withhold the one, I forget, it was the ice cream one, where they said the 5 day suspension was the correct level.
Yes. Yeah. That was one of the ones in which he had notice.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that it's the ones without notice that came in through the back door when the letter was written to him, where there's no due process at all.
That's correct. On the four of the seven charges, on the three charges, they complied with the requirements of Loudermill. On four charges, they did not. And then they stated, and it was more than a letter, it was official notice that he was demoted because of of all those charges. And I know of no case that says Loudermill gives the decision maker the power to pick and choose which ones they'll give notice to and which ones they will not. And I think the law is clear, because we did talk about qualified immunity in the district court, that the law was clear under Loudermill at the time that they denied him any due process, or any pre-deprivation due process, on the four charges. And that question of what injunctive relief he would be entitled to, in view of the fact that that his position, there was a reorganization, is one that, under your decision in the Dahl case, should be made at the time that there is a ruling on the merits of his claim, 1983 claim.
Your theory is that there are at least disputed issues of fact about whether the unit manager positions are the equivalent of the old unit, whatever they're called, unit director positions are the equivalent of his old job?
I'm saying that when you look at the equities, now I don't think there's every single person that was held his position at the time of reorganization became a unit manager. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that the question as to, because you do have other people who come in, you have people who took those positions, what should be the proper disposition at that time? One of them might be, which you did talk about in Dahl, would be to remove one of the incumbents. Another would be to put them on a waiting list until an opening happened. There would be other considerations, and that is to be determined by the trial judge, assuming we're successful in the court below, if mm-hmm. the appeal is granted. If there are any other questions, I'll save my
time. You can save some time for rebuttal if you like.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Moriarty?
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. May it please the Court. The undisputed facts make it clear, and the Personnel Commission decision made it clear, there were only four charges.
Why did the notice mention watching TV too much then?
That was one of the failure
to follow instructions.
The four charges, the four work rule three of the work rule violations had to do with those activities. One of the work rule violations had to do with not providing full and complete information at the time that the pre-disciplinary hearing occurred. That letter of demotion listed, here's what the problems are. That's what was appealed from. That's what went to the Personnel Commission. The Personnel Commission saw only four charges and addressed those four charges. If there was any claim that if there were seven charges, three of which there was no notice of beforehand, the Personnel Commission was the time to raise and resolve that.
But
that,
you know,
did not occur.
Obviously, there is no exhaustion requirement, and I'm quite prepared to agree with you that in terms of rights under Wisconsin law, Mr. Sonleitner's failure to serve in time to take his appeal from his effort to enforce. Obviously, he's not going to appeal from the Personnel Commission decision because it was favorable to him. So
it's to enforce the order.
He wants to see enforcement. He doesn't get the service in within 60 days. The state law claim is gone. But I'm not familiar with any case that says, aside from the prison context, which is quite different from here, that says you must go to a state court to assert your federal claim.
No.
Why in your view did he have to do that?
The federal claims here are whether or not he received proper procedural due process. That does get implicated with state law. And the reason is because we have here an agency acting to demote.
So if
then
we
you've
thought
got due process that occurs.
If we thought that there was not adequate notice, obviously we'll review this, but and if we agree with you that there was, then he got the process to which he was entitled. But if he did not receive pre-deprivation notice of the latter part of the charges, not the things about the gumballs and the ice cream and that kind of stuff, but the failure to do the job properly kinds of charges, then I take it you would agree that there is, under Loudermill, under Gilbert, under Swank, under other decisions of this court, a problem.
Well, if, in fact, there was some problem with the pre-deprivation notice that was given and the pre-deprivation proceedings, then we look to what happened. Well, first, let's look at whether there was any economic loss. The first thing, there was none. In fact, there was economic gain.
What if he wasn't working the night shift?
Excuse me?
I think there's no economic loss because when you couple the shift premium he gets, he makes more money.
Exactly. But that is what happened. That's the job to which he moved, and he gets it all the time. It's not a fluctuating thing.
Okay.
But that's a question of damages, and I take it the position of
Your Honor, it's not a question.
No, wait a minute. Let me give you this hypothetical. He's in a supervisory position as a nurse at this facility. Suppose these things happen, and the facility decides, well, we're not going to hassle with actually firing him. We're going to put him on the job cleaning toilets for the rest of his life, and we're going to make sure his salary is the same. Is it your position that there is no loss in that sense, that a demotion of that magnitude isn't something he can complain about?
There does need to be for procedural due process claims. Other claims may exist, but for procedural due process claims, the Bordelon case, the Townsend case, the Kavanaugh case that we've cited, talk about the need for economic harm.
And do you think that the premium that he has to be paid
now,
in order to...
Let me follow up with that, Your Honor, for a second. If we put somebody on cleaning toilets for the rest of their career and they're 30, that's going to affect their future career prospects and therefore may constitute economic harm, but we don't have that here.
Well, I don't know whether we have that here or not. I think the state's position is an extreme one, considering that we've recognized that demotions, even if the salary stays the same, are an adverse employment action. They are something that do affect somebody's potential for promotion, somebody's potential for other responsibilities, even if it's not a formal promotion. And I'm a little worried about the economics of your argument, because he gets the premium because the night shift is a bad job. People don't like to work at night. Well, because he needs the money, probably.
Well,
no,
he said he freely chose it for other reasons. Not
to pay
not
people
that.
Extra to do more. I'm not sure that means that the net salary is the same.
Your Honor, the point is, looking at the facts, he chose it because he said that's the shift he wanted to do, and he just didn't want
to
be working with other
people.
Something
extraordinary to get earn it, though. He's got to work on a night shift.
Yeah.
But
so
it's not comparable with some situation where he doesn't do anything extraordinary. It doesn't seem to me.
Beyond the economic claim, there's a whole number of reasons that these claims fail. One is there was abundant post-deprivation due process. The Personnel Commission proceeding went itself constituted post-deprivation.
So is it your position that post-deprivation due process can cure a failure of pre-deprivation?
That's been the court's ruling.
Said that.
That's been the court's ruling, absolutely, that if there's adequate post-deprivation process, it does cure the lack of proper pre-deprivation process. That has been the court's ruling. Obviously, you look at the facts and you look at the circumstances, but no doubt it does occur. That's been the court's ruling. And the Supreme Court's rulings as well.
Well, then no one would ever bother the pre-deprivation process.
But we've got post-deprivation as a problem. Then we look to the claims themselves. We have official capacity claims. We can't have official capacity claims. We don't have any ongoing constitutional violations. That ended when he failed to file the enforcement action to try to get a new job. What's left? What would the district court have authority to do?
The district court would have the authority to put his name on a list for the next comparable management position that comes open, which is a very common remedy in these kinds of cases.
That would be if the court found that there was a due process violation in the demotion.
Correct.
Which was not cured by the entire personnel commission process, which was not cured by the statutory process
thereafter.
And which
thereafter. Was not cured by the state's failure to implement the order of the Wisconsin Personnel Commission.
The order, by the way, only said set aside the demotion and do a 5-day suspension. They set aside the demotion in the records.
But
then there was no job to which to put him.
Exactly, but jobs like that have come open. Of course we don't require bumping, but there are many instances where we say, wait in line, the next one that comes open will be yours. You're first on the list.
Mr. Sontlinger had the perfect opportunity to show in the record that there were other jobs that came open. He did not do so.
I believe it's on your website, but anyway.
That's outside the record, Your Honor, the summary judgment record.
But you thought there was nothing the district court could do, and I should think that an order like that from the district court would have been within the authority of the court, and if no jobs had ever come open, he'd still be where he is. If a job had come open, he might not be. So we don't need to know, actually, if one did or not.
Procedural due process, Your Honor, only requires fair process. It does not require an exhaustively thorough process. It also does not require that the state hold open jobs on the possibility that somebody from the past might need to be put in for them.
Nobody's saying that. I mean, that's a red herring, I think. I think the only question
is,
does procedural due process allow a state to disregard what its own authority has said and not follow up in an appropriate way?
What we need to do, Your Honor, is look at what the situation was when the commission order was entered, and the agency was under the gun to comply with that order and do so quickly because the enforcement action did have to be filed in 60 days. They looked at it and said promptly, here's what we're going to do. We don't have any positions available. We will void the demotion. It is not on your record anymore. We'll put in a 5-day suspension, and we're going to implement that. That's what we can do. We can't do anymore. And look, you're already making more money than you would have, so there's no economic loss. Tell us what more we can do. Instead, Mr. Sontwigner tried and failed to file an enforcement action. So it's a question of what is the state supposed to do? And when we get to qualified immunity on the individual capacity claims, it's a question of what was clearly established that alerted them to what they were supposed to do at the time. All this speculation about what the state might do now or what is available now is irrelevant on a qualified immunity issue. So if we get to that...
Of course, there'd be no qualified immunity in terms of an injunction just to put him on the list. Qualified immunity relates to damages.
An injunction? Why would there be an injunction when we have a statute, a Wisconsin statute, that provided him the ability to enforce this personnel commission decision, and now what he's doing is going to federal court and saying, oh, give me an additional right beyond what the state has given me to enforce this order. From where? From where?
From federal law.
No, federal procedural due process rights derive from state law.
No. Your underlying interest derives from state law.
Precisely.
The amount of process that is due in a particular situation is a question of federal law.
Absolutely, Your Honor. No question about it. And I agree fully. I do think there are multiple grounds to affirm here. I've laid them out in my brief, and I'd ask that the decision be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Moriarty. Mr. Williamson?
Minute and a half.
Speak fast.
Okay. Briefly, and loud and ill, one of the people who constitutional right was upheld to a pre-deprivation hearing was given full post due process, and indeed found guilty. Nonetheless, they held that that was a violation of his constitutional rights. The relief Mr. Sumleitner is seeking is for a violation of his constitutional rights. And that is the relief in terms of the injunctive relief. The relief in terms of the damages is that he, all the damages that are given for a deprivation of a pre-deprivation.
Hard for me to see how he'd get more than a dollar, though, because in terms of actual damages, yes, he's been working a night shift, but it's going to be awfully hard for him to show any economic deficit.
I think you're correct there, Your Honor. By the way, the statute not only says demotion, and you have no cases. All the cases that have been cited by counsel were transfers, lateral transfers, not demotions. But the demotion reduced his salary, his base salary as well. The only reason he's making that much more money. But under this constitutional theory that the state is saying, whether the defendant violated his constitutional right depends on what the victim of that violation does subsequently. That cannot be the law. And it is not the law, and it is not consistent with any of the decisions of this circuit.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We appreciate it. We will take the case under advisement.